I'll talk about some fairly recent work, but many of the ideas, as you'll see, go back to the very early days of the cuprates. This is work in collaboration with several of these people here. Main Christos is a graduate student at Harvard. Henry, also a graduate student, and Alexander Nikolenko. Zhuxi Lo is a postdoc. Matthias Scheuer used to be at Harvard, but now will soon be a professor at Stuttgart. Darshan Joshi is in the faculty at TFR Hyderabad, and Yahui Zhang on the faculty at Johns Hopkins. Okay. And Jonas was a visiting student from Munich. Okay, so here's you know, after 30 years plus years of work on the high temperature superconductors, here's a summary, relatively recent, of, you know, the very complex phase diagrams these systems exhibit. This is as a function of temperature and hole doping. I mean, depending on the audience, I just assume everyone's familiar with this. I don't know if that's the case here or not. Anyway, so the green region is the high temperature superconductor, which is D-wave pairing. And then at finite temperature above the superconducting critical temperature, you have different types of metallic phases. I won't say anything about the strange metal today anyway. My focus will be here on this region of the phase diagram called the pseudogap. Another striking feature of these materials is that as you lower the temperature, depending upon which material you're looking at and whether you apply a magnetic field, you don't get the superconductor, but you can get various other states with interesting types of charge density wave order. All right. So there are many open questions about this phase diagram. Most important, of course, is what is the value of TC? We're still a long way from computing that. But hopefully some of these ideas that I'm going to present will, you know, at least point the way, the problems that need to be solved to finally answer the big question of what is TC. Okay, so first of all, beginning where things are fairly well understood in the so-called overdope regime, if you look at the Fermi surface, you have what's called the large Fermi surface. And the characteristic feature of this Fermi surface is that it encloses a volume which is exactly that you would expect from free electrons. So this is a system, if I'm considering, as I presume you all know, a copper square lattice of copper atoms, then there's one electron per copper where p is zero. So, or one hole, I'll talk in terms of holes, and p holes are added. So the total number of holes should be 1 plus p, and if you look at the area enclosed by this Fermi surface, it's exactly 1 plus p. So the Luttinger theorem is obeyed, and you can believe that the free electron theory is a good starting point, at least for understanding the Fermi surface and the excitations around it. However, if you go to very low doping, then you get all kinds of bizarre phenomenon. Sometimes people call this the Fermi arcs. This is the pseudogap regime where there's now no zero energy excitations in this region of the Brillouin zone. That's part of the pseudogap. But there are low energy excitations only along these arcs. Okay. So one of the big questions always has been, how can you describe this? And I think that's starting to be fairly well understood, at least I believe. And I'll present some of the ideas related to that. Then the question you can ask is, well, suppose I start with this strange pseudogap metallic state and I lower the temperature, I'm going to get D-wave superconductivity. So why do I get D-wave superconductivity? And why do, under certain conditions, do I get charge density wave order of some types, or stripe order, as people call it. But moreover, the critical temperatures for the onset of TC in a superconductor in zero field and the onset of charge order in high fields are almost the same. Why is that the case? Why are that these instabilities almost equivalent to each other, and just a tiny change will tip the balance between one or the other? So that's another major question that we can ask. If you started from the Fermi liquid, and we have a well-developed theory of the onset of superconductivity in a Fermi liquid. That is the BCS theory. And we also have a well-developed theory for the onset of charge density wave order in a Fermi liquid. And in that theory, there's no reason at all for these two temperature scales to be the same. Furthermore, there's this famous quantum oscillations that was seen now in 2007. That's at very low temperatures in a high magnetic field, high enough in a pure enough sample that you have destroyed the superconductivity. And so you see these quantum oscillations, first seen by Louis Taillefer's group and since by many other groups in several other compounds. And it's been confirmed by X-ray scattering that when you have these oscillations, there is charge density wave order. So there's no doubt about that. So then the question is, what is causing these oscillations? So there is a well-developed theory of such oscillations. They come from basically Landau level formation of electrons moving in a magnetic field. But the period of the oscillations tell you something important about the Fermi surface, in particular the size of the Fermi surface. So people have tried to understand this detailed structure of these oscillations. That's a whole story I won't go into. And I think everyone seems to agree that the oscillations are due to a single electron pocket of size p. And one way you can get such a pocket is by starting from the large Fermi surface, that's the black line, and adding some charge density wave order on top of it. And then you can get this red pocket, which is roughly consistent with the observations. But what you also see in any such theory is you get lots of low energy excitations, open orbits in the antinodal regions. You just can't get rid of those. And there's no experimental sign of those. It's pretty clear that they're not there. So that's another major puzzle. How do you understand these oscillations? They cannot be understood in a theory where you start from a Fermi liquid. All right. So what I'm going to present is our current, the current understanding of us and many other people of what the pseudogap metal is. And then the new results will be trying to do for the pseudogap metal what has done long ago for the Fermi liquid. What are the instabilities of a pseudogap metal? How does it go superconducting? How does it go become a spin density wave order? And we'll see actually some of the ideas that Ruben just presented will be important here in the sense that the pseudogap metal necessarily has a version of topological order. And the onset of these low temperature phases is a confinement transition where you lose the interesting topology. Okay, so that will be the theme of the talk. All right, so to get anywhere, we have to first have a theory for the pseudogap metal. So that's also another long talk, which I will abridge here, just to summarize the basic ideas. So the basic proposal I'm going to begin with, that these arcs, so this is experimental data, are really remnants of an actual pocket. So this is a theoretical calculation in this paper in particular, where you have high spectral density in the front of a pocket and very low spectral density at the back. I don't know, I can't even see it. Yeah, you can see the lines at the back. Okay, so and disorder and finite temperature makes it harder to see those on the experiments. So that's the proposal, that there are whole pocket Fermi surfaces of size p with charge E and spin half quasiparticles. And this kind of structure actually has appeared in many different theories over the years, especially in dynamical mean field theory, as far as the fermionic excitation spectrum is concerned, we get about the same results. Okay, there's some details of differences in detail. But there's one very important, before I get to that point, there's also been a very nice, interesting experiment recently. This is the angle-dependent magnetoresistance experiment. This is a simpler baby version of quantum oscillations, which you can do in a dirtier sample. And what you're doing here is you apply a magnetic field on the sample, And you measure how the resistance of the sample changes as you change the angle of the magnetic field. And in the presence of a magnetic field, the quasi-particles, whatever they are, will go in some orbits. And from the motion along those orbits, you can deduce how the resistivity will vary with angle. So this is a well-established technique in many, many materials. It works beautifully. If you apply it to the cuprates at large doping, where you have a Fermi liquid, you get exactly the right answer. It agrees beautifully with experiments, with photoemission experiments. On the other hand, if you apply it to the underdoped regime, you get a completely different shape. And then you have to guess what Fermi surface is working. And in fact, precisely the type of Fermi surface I mentioned, which is here, does the trick. It fits the angle-dependent magnetoresistance best. Okay, so that's not a proof, but it's as close as you're going to get. In fact, there is a little bit of a Fermi surface at the back, which is not visible in photoemission. In fact, theoretically, it's hard to imagine you can just have an arc. It's mathematically just makes no sense, really. Anyway, so there had to be something in the back, and this is some evidence for it. The point here, of course, is that in a photoemission experiment, you're removing a bare electron from the sample. So in that experiment, the wave function of the quasiparticle and how close it is to a bare electron matters. So basically, at the back of the pocket, the wave function of the quasiparticle is very different from the bare electron. On the other hand, here, you're not removing any electrons from the sample. So you don't even care what the wave function of the quasiparticle is. All you need to know is its dispersion and its charge. And once you know that, it'll give you the result. So the quasiparticle wave function doesn't affect these kind of transport properties. Anyway, let's assume for the rest of the talk that there indeed are such pockets in this pseudogap metal. But now, if you now think about it in a more non-perturbative way, there's essentially a theorem going back to arguments of Oshikawa and Van Hastings and others, which when applied to this metallic system, says that the point being that this kind of whole pocket Fermi surface violates the Luttinger theorem. The Luttinger theorem is the one I mentioned for Fermi liquid, that the volume enclosed by the Fermi surface must equal modulo 2, the density of all the electrons. And this is not true for this state. It violates it by exactly one electron per site. And so what's now been realized is that the topological order is a powerful tool which allows you to get all kinds of new phases. In particular, you can get a phase where where that missing one electron in the Luttinger theorem is taken up by a spin liquid. So it really requires in the theory that there be this spectator spin liquid around. At least as far as the photoemission is concerned, it's a spectator. And in fact, the spin liquid is exactly at half filling because it's one electron that's missing. Okay, so that has to be there, and this is something, you know, us and them have been arguing about, is it there or is it not? But the rest of my talk is really about, not only does it have to be there, but it's crucial for understanding the many physical properties. So that's what I'm going to get to now.
Okay, I'm going to select the reconstruction by Einstein metric, so that's...
That was a theoretical model that they used, yes.
I guess that's, yeah, so you don't agree with that interpretation.
I'm saying that there's a very small difference between the reconstruction by pi pi and this Fermi surface. They're pretty similar. It would be useful to redo the analysis precisely this Fermi surface and see if they fit better, but that hasn't been done. Okay. They just mentioned this as an example, but in these experiments, it's very clear there is no pi pi order. I mean, they're just not there. Okay. So first, let me give you just a very cartoon picture of why this spin liquid has to be there, and what are these whole pockets made up of? These pocket Fermi surfaces. So let's start with an antiferromagnet. These are the copper sites. And you remove a few electrons, so you have p holes per site. Now, in the resonating valence bond picture, the spins will pair up to form valence bonds, and they will resonate with each other. And then these vacancies can also move around. As you can just see from this picture, the motion of these vacancies just carries only charge but no spin. So these are what people call holons. And if these holons were fermions, then they could form a little Fermi surface, and you would have what you call a holon metal. The only problem is that's not what's seen in experiment, because in a holon metal, these are not electrons. So if you did a photoemission experiment, you would see the convolution of a spin, the spin spectral function with the holon spectral function. And if the spins have a gap, as in this picture, then you would actually not even see a Fermi surface in photoemission. So the holon metal could explain the ADMR, but they cannot explain the photoemission. All right, so what do we have to do to fix this picture? Well, you have to introduce the spins into the game. And so there's a few spin-ons. These objects are spin-ons, carrying spin but no charge. And they can move around, and they may cost some energy. But what the important point I want to notice is that there's actually a strong attractive interaction between a holon and a spin-on. In fact, the attractive interaction is of a strength T. So that particular object has a hopping matrix element T, so it'll can form a bound state. So there's the bound state, this green object, which is a holon and a spin-on in the symmetric combination. So in the bound state of a holon and a spin-on is otherwise known as an electron. So you've done a lot of hard work to split the electron into holon and spin-ons, and now you put it back together. Well, not quite. You not put all the electrons back together. You've only put p electrons back together, not 1 plus p. In terms of holes, it's 1 plus p. So there's only a small number of electrons that are now in an electron-like form. And so now this is the state, which we call FL star, that we want to think about. So if you look at the state in a colorblind way, it just looked like a spin liquid, just resonating dimers. But if you're sensitive to the charge, then you see the spin a half charge E fermions moving around, which will form the pocket. Okay? So this is the toy model picture of everything I'm going to talk about. And everything from now on is just a lot of technology and how you actually deal with such states, where you've got a background spin liquid of dimers along with these chargy spin a half quasi particles. Okay.
Sorry,
yes.
Well,
it doesn't matter for this picture because the bound state is always a fermion. The green objects are always fermions in anybody's picture.
Can I see this from this picture?
Yeah, well, usually, if I take a very simple point, if you take an electron, which is a fermion with charge E and spin a half, and I split it into holon and spin-on, in some people's pictures, the holon is a fermion, the spin-on is a boson, or vice versa. But in both cases, when you bind them, you still get a fermion. I mean, you get back the electron, basically. So the green objects are always fermions, but there's a lot of freedom in exactly how you build this up, and there are these valence bonds around, but the spin-ons, where are the spin-ons? The spin-ons here, these spin-ons, they could be bosons or fermions, and in fact, as you'll see, it's very useful to use that freedom to understand what's going on. That I'm going to come to that one. All right, so these are cartoon pictures, and in fact, they're a little bit more than cartoons. You can take this picture and write down some dimer models, which is what we did in this paper here, and actually compute things, and you can indeed get an electron spectral function that looks very much like what's observed. But we want to do much better. We want to take a very general theory of such a state and really do a systematic analysis of how it confines into a D-wave superconductor. Okay, so the theory that we're going to use is due to an idea of Yahui Zhang, which is called the ancilla theory of the Hubbard model. So let me just take a few slides to explain it, just the basic idea. You don't need to understand, you know, we've written several papers on it, and many of the papers are, the papers are really all about understanding various quantum phase transitions in that model, including especially the transition between the pseudo-gap and the Fermi liquid. And Liujun also has some very nice papers addressing similar issues. But for now, I just want to, if you want to just understand the phases, it's really very simple. So let me try to explain it. So we start out with the Hubbard model. This is a square lattice. I'm only showing it edge on. And again, I'll just talk in terms of holes. So the density is 1 plus p. So if you had a Fermi surface, you'd have size 1 plus p. And so the heart of the idea is this following mapping. So this is a, you can call it a Schieffer-Wolf transformation. These are two different models initially. But once you're done with it, they're really talking about the same Hilbert space. But we're just going to capture it in a slightly different way, in a way that'll give you some freedom to build more complicated states. I'm realizing these are words that Rubin said in a very different context earlier, and for very different things. But anyway, so here's the new model. You take the original square lattice of electrons with the Hubbard repulsion U and replace it by free electrons on the square lattice. Okay. But then you add a bilayer antiferromagnet. So these are two extra square lattices. These are ancilla square lattices or ancilla qubits. And these ancilla qubits are in two layers and coupled to each other by a coupling J-perp. So if the J-perp goes to infinity, then these two layers, S1 and S2, will just form rung singlets and they're out of the problem, and you just have free electrons. Okay, that's too far, so you don't want to take J-perp to infinity. You want the Hubbard model. Well, so let's imagine J-perp is large. So when J-perp is large, there's also a triplet excitation on each rung, which is now, you know, which we have to get rid of because that's high energy state. And imagine, let's imagine also there's a Kondo coupling between the mobile electrons and the top layer of spins, which is JK. And it's I choose that to be antiferromagnetic. So here's my ancilla Hamiltonian. It's just free electrons, bilayer antiferromagnet, and a Kondo coupling between S1 and the mobile electrons. That's it. Okay, now I just make a simple observation. When J-perp is large, I can get rid of the triplet state of the S1 and S2 in some kind of canonical transformation, that so-called Schieffer-Wolf transformation. So the same transformation you use to go from the Hubbard model to the Heisenberg model, you now apply to this model. And it turns out when you do that, you just get back a Hubbard model. And the value of U is JK squared over J-perp. And easy to see that, because when there's a spin a half here, it can lower its energy by coupling to the triplet, and only then. And so spin half filling is better than either empty or doubly occupied, and that's exactly the effect of a U. Okay, so this is a rewriting of the Hubbard model. We haven't done anything. But now let's try to solve this model, and let's think about the Kondo effect happening now between this electron and these, the top layer of the spins and the bottom layer. So if I think of the Kondo effect, this is coupled antiferromagnetically to the top layer, and there's an effective coupling you can derive between the top layer and the bottom layer, which is ferromagnetic, because these two are antiferromagnetic, that must be ferro. Now if I had just a single spin coupled to these mobile electrons, we know that the Kondo coupling flows this way. An antiferromagnetic coupling flows to infinity, while ferromagnetic coupling flows to zero. So even though I started out in a model where JK is much smaller than J-perp, let's imagine that because of some renormalizations, eventually JK becomes larger than J-perp. Let's ask what are the possible phases of this model. And those phases are exact, turns out to be exactly what we need. So when JK is small, which is presumably what happens at large doping, then the Rung singlets form, and you just get a Fermi surface of size 1 plus p. That's the Fermi liquid. On the other hand, what happens when JK is large? Well, JK is large, then I only consider the top two layers to begin with. And the top two layers form a Kondo lattice. Now, here I'm going to assume a little bit about Kondo lattices. So what Kondo lattices do, as we know from the heavy fermion compounds, is they form what's called a heavy Fermi liquid. And the heavy Fermi liquid is heavy because the quasiparticles are heavy. But more importantly, it has what's called a large Fermi surface, where the size of the Fermi surface counts not just the electrons, but also the spins. And this has been observed experimentally in literally hundreds of compounds. Okay, so let's assume that the top two layers do exactly that. So they're going to form what's called a large Fermi surface. But here, curiously, the large becomes small because the density of holes on the top is 1 plus p. The density of holes on the second layer is 1. That gives me 2 plus p. But remember, in counting Fermi surfaces, I only count modulo 2, because 2 electrons per unit cell is a filled band that can always be removed. Therefore, the size of the Fermi surface is p. Okay, so we've got what we wanted. We've got these hole pockets that you see in the experiments, ADMR experiments and photoemission experiments. But we also have, because the theory is internally consistent, and that's the whole point of this theory, it's all designed so that all these anomalies and all these theorems are foolproof. They'll just come out correctly. The theory tells you there must be a spin liquid at the bottom. So these spins are still left over, and there's this missing spin liquid. It is there because this is an internally consistent theory. And that is this FL star phase, where you've got a small Fermi surface of size p and a spin liquid here. And unlike the simple dimer model I showed you, this could be any spin liquid you wanted. You know, so that's another advantage of this approach. There's been a huge amount of progress in classifying and understanding spin liquids in the last 25 years. We can use all of it. There's also been a huge amount of progress in understanding the Kondo lattice heavy Fermi liquid, both theoretically and experimentally. And we can use all of that. All we have to do is just couple these two systems together. And you immediately, at zeroth order, you get what's observed in photoemission. So the talk is really about, well, how do you couple them together and what can you get? So this is the main slogan I want you to remember. Soda gap metal is a Kondo lattice heavy Fermi liquid and a spin liquid. Okay.
Question.
Yes?
So can I get the spin liquid on the left as from some projected dope-free fermion?
You don't have to dope it. In fact, that's the point. It's undoped free fermion wave function. The doping is in the top two layers. That's the point. It's an undoped spin liquid. So this was, I think, when you're talking about, that was kind of the point of these pictures. When you're thinking about this state, this looks like a doped spin liquid because the presence of the holes, of the holons, is certainly changing the way the dimers move. Okay, so this is a doped spin liquid. This picture, if you look at it in a colorblind way, is an undoped spin liquid. The dimers are still doing their own thing as they were doing the insulator. It's just that some of them carry in charge. But okay, this is the zeroth order pick. But this Ancilla model makes this completely clear. That's a great question. This is a completely undoped spin liquid. It's exactly the same liquid that we have studied to death. Now we got all the PhDs all worked out. We don't have to change a thing. So you kind of take all the doping and put it in the Kondo lattice. And we understand how to deal with the Kondo lattice with mobile carriers. You know, that's the idea here. Okay, that's a perfect question. All right. So using this theory, you can fit the spectrum, as I've said, I won't go into it, both in the nodal region and the antinodal region. There's a lot of non-trivial structure in the antinodal region, and it all works very beautifully. Okay, So now the question is, you know, let's go to lower temperature and get what we actually see. So to understand what we actually see at lower temperatures, and we have to basically confine the spin liquid. So the spin liquid, now this state here, in principle, could be stable down to zero temperature if this spin liquid was stable. So if it was a Z2 spin liquid, the toric coat type spin liquid that Ruben talked about, in principle, there could be an FL star phase at zero temperature. And certainly that was a dream of mine for many years. Something like this would be seen. It's pretty clear that there's been no sign of it, okay, in any experiment.
Is it clear that once I go to the superconductor or CW, there's definitely no spin liquid?
Well, in most models, if you go to from FL star to a D-wave superconductor or SC star, you will have 8 nodes, not 4 nodes. I mean, there are certainly many signatures that have never been seen. I think I would say that at this point, we're going to take the point of view that whatever spin liquid was here is something that ultimately confines. And you, of course, know of a wonderful spin liquid that had exactly that property, and that's what I'm going to talk about. So ultimately, it would be great someday somebody finds a material in which this spin liquid is placed under zone temperature. I would be very, very happy. But I think in the cuprates, it's pretty clear that's not what's happening. And I've written too many papers based on that hope that you don't have to read anymore. Okay. All right, so question is which spin liquid, right? All right. And that turns out to be really the key. So I've set it up in a way. You want a spin liquid one. Number one, you want a spin liquid that leads to a D-wave superconductor, okay? Not any other spin liquid. It has to lead to a D-wave superconductor. You want a spin liquid in which charge order and D-wave superconductivity appear on the same footing. And it turns out there is one spin liquid that satisfies exactly those requirements. And that, in fact, is the oldest spin liquid in the book. So it started, I guess it first appeared in this paper in the paper of Arovas and Auerbach, already in 1988. You take the square lattice antiferromagnet, and you use a parton construction in terms of Schwinger boson. These are spin and a half bosons, which will eventually become the spinons in the low energy theory. And bosons being as they are, there's only two possibilities. Either the bosons can condense, in which case you just back to the nail state, or they can form a gap state, in this case by pairing up in a certain way. And that gap state then is your spin liquid, okay. So this is the simplest spin liquid that appears in a simple mean field theory of these bosonic partons. Okay. Around the same time, the very early days, there was another spin liquid that was looked at by Affleck and Marston, where they did almost exactly the same thing, but with fermionic spinons. So they wrote the spin operator in terms of fermionic partons and did some mean field theory. And they found that the energy was lowest, well, at least there was a locally stable saddle point, where when these fermions moved in a background of pi flux, okay. So these are fermions moving on pi flux, and just like electrons moving in on the honeycomb lattice, fermions moving in pi flux in the square lattice have two Dirac nodes. So this gives you gapless spinons at two Dirac points. And so this looks very, very different. This has bosonic gap spinons. This has fermionic spinons with gapless spectrum, Dirac spectrum. They look very different, but what we learned in the intervening time that at some deep level, especially due to beautiful work by Chong, these are the same theory. So how does that come about? Again, that will be a long talk, but I won't get into it here. If you look at the low energy theory of the Schwinger bosons, this turns out to have an emergent U1 gauge field. And these bosons become a relativistic boson Z. Sorry, there should be a dagger there. And so the low energy theory is actually a model familiar to field theorists, where you have a U1 gauge field A mu coupled to a relativistic complex scalar. And as you tune the mass of the scalar, when S is negative, the scalar will condense and you will get the nail state. This is the Higgs phase of the U1 gauge theory. And when S is positive, naively you would think you're going to get a Coulomb phase with complex bosonic spin-ons. But this theory, you have to now also put in monopoles, and when you play all of that song and dance with the monopoles, you find that it confines, and the confining state has valence bond solid order. Okay. All right, so then ultimately the gauge theory or the spin liquid isn't really there. It's either a Higgs phase or a confining phase. But close to the critical point, through many numerical studies in the intervening years, I'll show you some of them, it seems like at least up to some fairly large length scale, there is a spin liquid near the critical phase. And that's going to be my candidate spin liquid for describing the rest of the phase diagram. So, and then of course you could start with the fermionic spin-ons. There you get relativistic Dirac fermions coupled to an SU2 gauge field. And that SU2 gauge theory, just like any non-abelian gauge theory, can be confining. And in fact, today, again, the evidence is that it confines over after some long length scale. And once it confines, you get exactly the two same phases. And this identity of the phase, the confining phases, is basically part of a more general set of arguments given by Chong Wang et al. That these two theories are dual. Okay. All right, so that's the spin liquid I'm going to work with. It's been under our noses all these years. But we want to look at its confining and stability a little more carefully. And surprise, I thought this had been done for sure when I started thinking about this, but it hasn't, you know. People had done come very close, but for various reasons had gone off what to me now looks like the wrong path. All right, so here are some numerical evidence studies that I mentioned briefly. So this is there's lots of work. This is Zheng Cheng Gu's group in Hong Kong. You take a square lattice antiferromagnet with first and second neighbor couplings, where the first neighbor couplings are, in this paper, not the same on the x and y direction. But let's put it equal, these two equal. That's this line then. So along this line, you have the valence bond solid and the antiferromagnet. Ignore the stripe. That's some large J2 phase that has no connection to anything I'm saying. There's a strong first order line here. And in between, there's, you know, what they claim it's a QSL, but if it's a QSL, it's probably some other Z2 QSL at very low energies. But nevertheless, in this study and many other studies, there's very good evidence for this SO5 symmetry I mentioned here, which rotates between the three-component nail state and the two-component valence bond solid state.
Actually, Sabir,
yeah.
For cuprate, what's the realistic range for
you? Yeah, so the good point. Cuprates are like 0.1 or something. So these cuprates are not there, for sure. Okay. But nevertheless, there's these very nice papers by Hongchen Jiang and Steve Kibbleson in the last few years, who took this state. They actually sat exactly around here, and they doped it and did DMRG studies. And what they found, and this is actually you know, a first, really, despite 30-plus years of numerical work on the cuprates on various lattice models, a very clear sign of just D-wave superconductivity. So if you do the, now there's a lot of work, you know, starting, you know, if I draw a phase diagram, here's doping and J2 over J1, then there's some spin liquid phase here that I'm discussing. And of course here there's an antiferromagnet and presumably there's a D-wave superconductor here. Now, of course, what you should do this is go this way, and there's no shortage of studies doing that. And what they find there is that getting the D-wave superconductor is kind of a delicate thing, depending upon exactly how you choose the boundary conditions, exactly which parameters you choose. You either get a D-wave superconductor or some kind of charge order. What they're doing in this paper is coming this way, and they immediately get a D-wave superconductor and nothing else. That's what they say here. It's very cleanly, more cleanly than anything else, which is why, you know, high temperature superconductivity. It's one of the first evidences of high temperature superconductivity in a numerical study of the Hubbard-like model. Okay, so that actually, you know, perfect for us because, as I've just said, the spin liquid here, in this regime, which is precisely where they are working, there's a huge amount of numerical evidence. It's just this spin liquid, okay. So we're going to just work with that and see what else comes out correctly. All right, so we're going to talk about confinement of fractionalized excitation in the spin liquid. And see what you get in this Ancilla model. Okay, so this is kind of what we're going to do. So here's our spin liquid. Now, if the spin liquid just confined as it always does, you'll just get the nail state. Okay, you'll get this antiferromagnet. Or there's no sign of valence bond solid in the experiment, so let's say you get the nail state. But we want, is there any other way for it to confine? Well, so in this model, there's another way for it to confine. So first of all, now I have to get into a little bit of technology. The way you describe the large Fermi surface is by representing the spins with fermions, which I call F1 and F. So the spin liquid I've been talking about is this fermionic spinons with Dirac dispersion, that's this F. Now the way you get this Kondo lattice heavy Fermi liquid is you turn on so-called hybridization between the electrons and the F. So when this Higgs field condenses, then the spin liquid that was here becomes part of the Fermi surface and you get the large slash small Fermi surface. Okay. All right. So now these F form a pi flux spin liquid with an SU2N gauge field. I'm calling it N because there's another SU2 gauge field that Lucian and I have worried about. That has to do with the top two layers. I'm not going to talk about that. N for Nambu here. Okay. So now we see that there's another boson, another Higgs boson that can condense to confine this SU2 gauge field. So ultimately, we have to confine the SU2 gauge field to get the ordered phases. And what is that Higgs boson? So it has a fundamental of SU2, and it also carries charge E. It's just the overlap between these two layers, between F1 and F. And you can do that in the normal or the anomalous channel, and these are the Nambu components in the SU2N space. And notice as far as the F1 is concerned, it's always an F1 dagger, so that's why it has charge E, because F1 effectively has charge E because of this Higgs condensate. Okay, a lot of technicalities, but this is how you set it up. So basically, you start with the SU2 gauge theory of this spin liquid, and then ask for the effective action for the Higgs boson. Now, in practice, that's a very complicated calculation, but what we have learned in the last 20-plus years is you can say a lot just by understanding something about the symmetry structure of the spin liquid, or so-called projective symmetry group. That's really all you need. So we're going to do a Landau theory using the projective symmetry group of this boson B. And this boson B is actually the same as introduced by Wen and Li in 96 in a very different formulation where they were really talking about the doped spin liquid in the way of the holon metal, actually, or the some other corresponding phase where the holons are bosons. The point is that, we started doing this, we just have to open up Wen and Li, they probably worked it out. They haven't, they didn't work it out for various reasons. Most important being that they weren't thinking in terms of all the charge going into the pockets in electron-like objects. That wasn't part of their thinking. Anyway, but it's really extremely simple to do. So what do? You start out with the structure of the fermionic spinons. Here's a pi flux representation. I make them purely imaginary because then you can rewrite it in terms of the number of spinners in this form. The Eij is just fixed to these gauge fields. And Uij is the SU2 gauge field. So there's your emergent SU2 gauge field. And now you can see explicitly that this action is SU2 gauge invariant. So there's an SU2 gauge theory coupled to massless Dirac spinons. Things extremely well known for a long time. All right, so now, but we're not interested in, so this theory by itself confines, but with a very long confinement scale. And we understand that pretty well today. Now we want to ask, is there any other route to confinement? Can we condense some other Higgs boson? Well, this charge E, SU2 fundamental Higgs boson is around. So now you have to ask, what is the effective action of this Higgs boson? Well, the world's simplest point is that if these fermions see a pi flux, then the bosons B should also see a pi flux, because the composite of the fermion spinon and the holon is just the boson, is the electron. So the hopping matrix element is essentially has exactly the same form with some other coupling W. There's some time-dependent terms I won't talk about. A mass term is now allowed without breaking any symmetries. And so now R is going to be our tuning parameter. When R is very large, then we can forget about these chargey objects, and you're back to the old story, and you just get an anti-ferromagnet. But when R is small or negative, then this B will condense. And all we're going to ask by symmetry is, you know, what are the phases it condenses to? It's really a very textbook calculation from this point on. So the first thing you have to do is also worry about the quartic terms in this Landau analysis. And these turn out to be the nearest neighbor quartic terms. There are many, really. It just explodes, of course, very quickly. And all of these are expressed in terms of gauge invariant objects, which are like the side charge density, the bond density, bond current, and the pairing amplitude. So now our task is to just minimize this action, find its various minima, and then study the broke, you know. It turns out, because of the pi flux, every such phase must break some symmetry. There is no trivial Higgs phase. You know, unlike the SU2 gauge theory of weak interaction, but the Higgs phase is trivial. There's no broken symmetry in the theory of weak interactions. Here, because of the pi flux, there is a broken symmetry, no matter what. And that's actually good. Otherwise, you run into some conceptual problems if you found a trivial phase. Okay, so the point is that the dispersion, at least for nearest neighbor terms, is the same between the fermions and the bosons. The fermions, of course, go near the Dirac nodes, but the bosons will go near the minima. And really, the key point here is that these minima are exactly degenerate. So how many bosons do I have? Well, first of all, there's the SU2 fundamental, so that gives you two complex bosons. And then there's two valleys, so there's four complex bosons, which are completely degenerate at quadratic order. And that's really what we need. So you're going to condense these bosons, and in terms of this B plus and B minus, you can now write down various order parameters, which are gauge invariant, and look at their symmetry transformation properties. And you find there's exactly five, and they have to be five because there are four complex bosons, which is eight real bosons. You mod out by SU2 or SO3, that gives you five, SO5 again. So there's an SO5 symmetry here, at least at quadratic order, and it's between these five states. One of them is the D-wave superconductor. So this is, you know, in fact, this was known in the very early days by, I think, Fuchin Zhang and Rice pointed out that you can rotate a pi flux phase into a D-wave superconductor. This is just, this comes out, this here is coming out in a gauge invariant statement, because rotation was, it was very confusing, because what are you rotating? It's just a gauge transformation. Here we're talking about gauge invariant objects. You can also get the d-density wave state. So that gives you three. And in fact, these two states were obtained by Wen and Li when they worked with a staggered flux phase, where these two are not degenerate.
Actually, sorry, so
Yeah.
probably with something basic. So the B carries U1 charge.
Yes.
So why don't I always get a superconductor when B condenses?
Well, because it's, you have to make a, it's not, it also carries SU2 gauge charge. So the question is, can you make a SU2 gauge invariant object which is which has charge? So there is a, there are certain, so the only SU2 gauge invariant object which has charge is this one. So this can be zero even when B condenses. I mean, it's very similar, it's sort of similar to why is it that when your slave boson condenses, you get a large Fermi surface,
well,
not a superconductor.
When it condenses, then it doesn't count as
superconductor. Yeah, I think the correct way to say it is you have a gauge symmetry, you have global symmetries. When you Higgs something, you break the gauge symmetry, but of course, you know, then you have to look at gauge invariant combinations of the condensate. And you ask, what are the symmetries that gauge invariant combination of the condensate break? That what identifies the phase. Okay, so when you do that, there are three different phases: the D-wave superconductor and the D-density wave. And those had been identified before, when people were working in the staggered flux phase, where there's only one complex boson. When there's a, sorry, there's a doublet of complex bosons, and a U1 gauge field. Here we have four complex boson and an SU2 gauge field. And then there's two more, and lo and behold, it is the striped states with period two in this case. Okay. All right, and so this order, in this theory, the striped state and the D-wave superconductor and the D-density wave are completely degenerate. But ever, the quartic terms will break symmetry, of course.
Okay.
Yeah.
So the D-wave superconductor has an imaginary class. That's the
They have opposite signs. The real, of course, there's an overall phase that you can change.
So what are the five components of the SO5?
So the, yeah, the D-wave superconductor has two components, correct. And D-density wave is one, and these are all real at this, yeah. Okay. So here's, so roughly speaking, these Higgs bosons, five Higgs bosons, oh, sorry, eight Higgs boson, which have a great charge, are the square roots of conventional order parameters. And so you just have to do a Landau theory for the Higgs field, and you get, I think, a very good starting point for what's going on.
So this is different from Chang's
SO5. It's, yeah, I will mention that in a minute. Okay. It is completely different. So if you, in terms of these quartic Landau parameters, these are the three phases, A, B, C, here, and this happens when B condenses. Now remember, I had this Higgs mass R. So if I make the Higgs mass R very large, then I have the nail, then the Higgs boson doesn't matter, and I have the nail and VBS. So here there was an SO5F, which I'm calling SO5F, which rotated between the nail order parameter and the valence bond solid. That's SO5F. Here I have SO5B, which rotates between the D-wave superconductor, the D-density wave, and the stripes. And Zhang's SO5 rotated between this and this. There's no such rotation here at all. There was a different SO5 between the D-wave superconductor and the nail state. I don't, so for this theory, in terms of if the Landau theory of B is good, then the statement is that both these SO5s are approximately good. That's the justification. Okay. All right, so now you can also include further neighbor couplings by putting in second neighbor hopping, and then the B dispersion can become more complicated. In particular, these minima can split into subsequent minima, all of which are degenerate. You get eight degenerate minima, so the possibilities of the states become very rich. There's even bigger than SO5 symmetries there. We haven't begun to analyze it, but you can get period four stripes and many other things. Anyway, but this is just simple mean field theory. What needs to be done, and what we're starting to think about and love to talk to people about it, is really do the full gauge theory. You know, take this theory here, just of the bosons even, with the fluctuating SU2 gauge field and understand something about its phase diagram as a function of temperature, for example. So this theory will have a TC of D wave superconductivity. And in the pseudo gap regime, you know, all these order parameters are fluctuating. Not, you know, so there's been interminable arguments on whether the pseudo gap is a fluctuating superconductor or a fluctuating stripe. Well, we say it's the fluctuating of the square root of both of them. Okay. All right, so this, I think I'm done. I've spoken too long, right? I started at 3:30. Oh, I'm exactly on time. Okay. So this is the global picture of what I've been talking about. The parent of everything is this FL star phase with hole pocket Fermi surfaces. And for today's discussion, absolutely crucial, a particular choice for a spin liquid that accompanies it. In fact, the pi flux spin liquid or the CP1 theory, whichever formulation you want to use. And that has a lot of nice properties, including this near degeneracy between charge order and superconductivity. And it has a D-wave superconductor, not an S-wave or anything else. So now you can, you know, I talked about arrow A, where you condense this B, and you can get also, you know, D-wave superconductor with charge order and also various circulating current phases, but those are presumably higher in energy if you do a more careful microscopic calculation. You could take the CP1 formulation and condense the Z, that's arrow B, then you will just get the metallic state with hole pockets and long-range nail order. And then finally, this is the work that Liu Jin and Debanjan have done, and Yao Hui and I have written many papers on, which is how you get the strange metal and going from here to here. And let me just say one word. That has to do with uncondensing this Higgs boson between the top two layers, whereas everything I've talked about today is for uncondensing or condensing the bottom two, the Higgs boson of the bottom two layers. Those are separate things, yeah. So in terms of future work, if I have two more minutes, what would be nice to see, really, if this picture is, you know, of course we can try to compute lots of things along arrow A, and we're busy doing that. But really, to have evidence, direct evidence, we have evidence of the hole pocket Fermi surface, it's pretty good, I think, by this point. But we want some direct observation of the spin liquid. And I think the most attractive candidate, actually, the data may already be out there. There's a lot of neutron scattering data now in the last few years on spin fluctuations in the pseudo gap at high energies. So, you know, I'll just show you this. Yeah, this data here in the Brillouin zone at very high energies, you see very broad and intense spin fluctuation spectrum. And this is what I was talking to Yu Zhuang over lunch. maybe some of the, I'm not sure social with the JQ model, but maybe some other more realistic model of spin liquid. But you only have to work with the insulating spin liquid could give you, and we could understand in detail all of these spectra that people are seeing. Okay, I'll stop there.
Questions?
Thanks for a nice talk. I remember one experiment, very crucial experiment, long back. Replace copper 2 plus by zinc 2 plus.
Yeah.
Then it is supposed to, within the spin liquid,
yeah.
Ampere spin on.
Right, yeah.
Now, also at that time, I remember there was some suggestion in the discussion that with the net spin would be half. You could have a spin one and a spin on together. So your ancillary spin might give some clue about it. Because the ancillary spin should be frustrated once you remove your copper atom and replace it by zinc. So the structure that you are thinking could be envisioned in your language.
I think that's right. Sure. I mean, the NMR, shows us some kind of moment, or and there's also now evidence of spin glass order once you put in zinc impurities.
Locally, you know, the net spin is half.
Yeah.
It could be made up of a spin one and a spin half.
Yeah, but how do you tell that? I mean, what we've been doing is, this is not published, but we've been computing STM spectra of zinc impurities in the Ancilla model.
Because these Ancilla is going to be frustrated.
Yeah.
Once you have a hole.
Right.
Missing sign. So
yeah.
It really is interesting.
Yeah, well, anyway, the STM has some very complicated DIDV, and you know, we can sort of match that, but we're still finishing that. That's not been written up yet. Yeah, but we've been thinking about the zinc impurities.
So we can test out, has
these non-trivial properties. Sorry, I'm sorry, I can't hear.
So the echo star has these non-trivial topological properties, which are responsible for the biology abundance here and all that.
Yes.
Excitations.
Yeah.
Is there any remnant of this in the supercapture, or
disappear? It all disappears. Well, there is one subtlety, I can come to that. But first of all, these are gapless spin liquids, so topology, you know, formally I can't use this, all these rigorous theorems for gapped spin liquids. Yeah. Yeah, so that's one caveat. But one remnant is that you can now ask, you know, how do you get the nodes in the D-wave superconductor? So what you can show is that when you condense the B and you go to the confining state, once you're in the confining state, all these, issues with all these restrictions coming from the PSG must disappear. But they may not disappear immediately. There may be some intermediate regime where there's some remnant of them. So in particular, if you just take, if you imagine this is a pi flux spin liquid, it's got four spin on nodes. And this is the FL star, it's got a pocket. Okay, so if you look at the Fermi surface, there's your pockets, and then there's your nodes from the spin-ons. And now you turn on superconductivity, you see that you get nodes, you get three nodes, you get 12 nodes, at least for small condensate of B. But then these two can annihilate, and eventually you get just four. But there could be a small region. No one's ever seen it, but if conditions are right, if the gauge fluctuations are not strong enough, where you have 12 nodes. But 12 is okay, because 12 can be smoothly connected to 4. If you had an SC star state, where the spin liquid still survived and the superconductivity was just the superconductivity of these holes, and these spin-ons remained spin-ons, then you would have 4 spin-ons and 8 nodes. That would be an exotic superconductor. So that would be an SC star. But this is just SC, it's not SC star.
Actually, I have a question.
So yeah.
In this scenario, will I predict that the transition, the almost low temperature transition from NAIL to the D-wave superconductor is almost continuous?
Well, so this is, I didn't talk about the time-dependent terms, then there's a particle hole asymmetry and so on at finite doping. But suppose you're able to study this transition at half filling, where you, with particle hole symmetry. So, you know, there could be some small U Hubbard model. There are various models out there. So suppose I cooked up a nice model which had a NAIL state, and a D-wave superconductor as two possible ground states at half filling. There's a candidate conformal field theory here, where you have a one SE2 gauge field, two massless Dirac fermions, and two massless relativistic bosons, which has SO5 cross SO5 symmetry, and hopefully that field theory exists. So there could be a true DQCP between two such states.
So do you know if you couple that to a Fermi surface, is the coupling relevant or?
Yeah, right. Or is the particle hole asymmetry relevant?
Yeah.
We don't know anything about it, even whether it exists. But I think given that when you didn't have any massless bosons, you're so close to existing, just add two massless bosons, it should exist. I mean, there is this work I did with Ashwin and Sneer. That was a transition from pi flux to some Z2 spin liquid, some orthogonal metal, actually, yeah. There we had not a fundamental Higgs, but we had an adjoint Higgs. And there, the numerical evidence seemed to be that there really was a CFT. But it'd be great to study that. I mean, even as a lattice gauge theory, you just need a lattice gauge theory with two massless fermions and two massless scalars and an SG2 gauge field. Yeah.
Yeah, in the current theory, the spin-up sector, it seems to be able to you describe it either by Dirac fermion or CP1 boson, which has really. What about the charge-on sector? Is there also a fermion description for the charge-on
sector? That ends up giving you various charge, some spiral density wave states and so on. Yeah. We have studied that in a different language once. But it doesn't give you a superconductor. I mean, the SU2 gauge field, yeah.
Is charge sector only condensed like symmetry and things like that?
Right.
For charge liquids or something.
Yeah, but so to go here from the pseudo-gap metal to a superconductor and charge order, you definitely, the fermionic spin-on picture is better. if you want to go to nail state, or if you want to, if you put in the charge fluctuation in the bosonic spin-on, you get a U1 gauge theory and you get strange spiral states and so on. We have studied that in the past, but it does seem as if the fermionic spin-on is better. And, since I've spent too much of my life on bosonic spin-ons, now I'm happy to see them appreciate the advantage of using fermionic spin-ons. Yes. Yeah.
Your ancilla fermion F1, is there any way to probe F1 directly?
Well, this is what I'm saying is being done by these experiments. I think in the end, this state here, this state of the coupled system has two sectors of low energy excitations. It has the excitations around the Fermi surface, which are the Fermi pockets, and has excitation of the spin-ons here. Those are the two sectors that you can see. Those are the low, that is the dominant sector. So these have been seen, and now I'm hoping that by detailed analysis of just an ordinary spin liquid, you can try to understand what they're seeing in neutron scattering in the doped system. Because the whole point here is that once you dope, all the dopant goes in the top. This spin liquid is largely untouched. Okay, at least its PSG doesn't change. You may have more couplings, J1, J2, some short range or some bigger, longer range couplings in there. But its PSG does not change. It's the same PSG.
I'm more worried about the itinerant fermion
pass. Oh, that's very small. There's just a small Fermi surface because of this Mod 2 thing. Yeah, that's just like they see that part, but that's a small part of the signal. Yeah. That gives you a particle hole continuum just like any Fermi liquid. It's exactly the same, but its overall spectral weight is not very large. It's about a P. Most of the spin spectral weight, I believe, is here in the bottom there. Yeah.
Thanks. Yeah. Maybe something from the experience. So you start with an SFI, that system has emerging SFI symmetry. So what point is that getting broken?
You mean for the bosons? These are the most general quadratic terms, the boson energy, with nearest neighbor terms. Okay. Even this doesn't have an SO5 symmetry. Now, if I take this dispersion and I just take the quadratic dispersion down here, then it has an SO5 symmetry. But all of these other terms here, these quartic terms, these are rho is, everything here is quadratic in the boson, all of these terms break SO5. So only the boson mass term and the kinetic energy have SO5 symmetry. Everything else is breaks it.
I guess I was thinking more in terms of the decay CP. think.
Oh, those for the fermions. There it's much more robust. I mean, there you have to go to quartic terms. No, I mean, it's similar. So this is full SO5 symmetry. But once you add four Fermi terms and so on, I mean, Chong's the expert on this, you will break the SO5 symmetry.
At least that's the belief.
So I would say that the best evidence for SO5 symmetry comes from numerical work. So there's a lot of numerical work, at least of this critical point, where people measure both the nail and the VVS order parameter, and they do find that, in fact, it looks like SO5 symmetric in the exponents and even the distribution functions and so on. And this is on many different models. In fact, the evidence for SO5 symmetry is, in fact, the strongest thing there is. It's stronger than the existence even of a critical point. Yeah.
So you can have a sketch theory simulation for SU2D state with two flavors and fermions. What's the status? Is it conformizable?
I think it's right at the border. I don't know. Maybe, you know. Are you Emily? Maybe you know. You're Emily Huffman, right? Maybe you know the answer to this question. What is the current status of SC2 gauge theory coupled to two massless fermions, two Dirac fermions? Yeah, is it conformal or not, or is it confining?
Yeah.
I think Bootstrap has ruled it out at this point, right?
Maybe some 5-year-old result I heard was that it wasn't conformal.
Yeah.
If you take the continuum limit.
There now there's stuff in press also, and Bootstrap has ruled this out.
Yeah.
But numerical work is just is very convincing.
Bootstrap gives you bounds.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. It gives you a bound and it pulls out. But yeah, then there are other models. It's kind of uncertain.
Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe there's a loophole there. But I would say, ignoring Bootstrap, I would say, with all the work by Anders Sandvik, and then there's also the work by Chalker and Powell, who looked at some loop models in three dimensions. They all give roughly consistent results that there's very good SO5 symmetry. But ultimately, once you go to about 100, 200 lattice spacing, there seems to be some violations of scaling.
I'm not questioning about the SO5 symmetry. I'm asking about the specific SU2 gauge to cover to those
Well, if the DQCP doesn't exist, I agree with you. What? If the DQCP doesn't exist, yeah, so it can't flow to it. Yeah, so you're asking, does it flow to the nail state or the VVS state or something else? That's what you're asking. I think we'll all agree it has to, I would say it flows to one of these two. Has that been confirmed? I don't know. It has to have one of these two broken symmetries. On the other hand, well, no. It's also a question of exactly how they're realizing the fermions. Because here the SO5 symmetries are anomalous in this theory. So when if you don't realize it in the right way, you won't get the. You're the expert on this. It's a question of how you realize that theory on the lattice. It may determine what you end up with. But, yeah. But if you just take this theory in the continuum, that's anomalous. But it does have an approximate SO5 symmetry. The other SO5 is not anomalous. It's fine.
All right, no more questions. Thanks, Spear, again.